It rained that morning like it had something to prove. Sharp, urgent needles of water that stabbed the tin roof of the brew shack like a threat. I'd been running the 3 a.m. to 8 a.m. shift at Java Junction for 6 months, long enough to know what kind of eyes watched you when your uniform was designed for tips. It was one of those roadside espresso kiosks, single window, single employee, all charm and show. My boss called it femme-forward branding. I called it a paycheck. I never minded the ogling. I'd mastered the art of eye contact without invitation. Men came and went. Construction foremen, graveyard techs, security guards pulling doubles. Most were harmless. Some tipped generously. One offered to pay my rent. Another asked if I'd pose for his espresso calendar. I laughed it all off. I was used to the game. Until that one shift. The shack sat alone off the interstate, tucked beside a 24-hour car wash that never opened before 9. The only light came from a busted halogen pole above the lot and the soft orange LED under the overhang. Beyond that, pure black, rain-slurred asphalt, and the glow of I-90 in the distance. It was isolated, which was exactly what creeped me out that morning. It started at 3:12. I was restocking the milk crates, phone charging behind the sink, music low, Billie Eilish whispering something sad into the speaker. I hadn't flipped the open sign yet. I was still in my hoodie, still invisible. Then came the buzz. Not the door chime, not a knock. A low, continuous hum. It was coming from the drive-thru window. Someone had pulled their car just close enough to trigger the motion sensor floodlight above the stand, but hadn't turned off the engine. I glanced over my shoulder. A black SUV. Could have been anyone. I stepped toward the window, hoodie still up, no makeup yet, teeth unbrushed. Not exactly how we were supposed to greet customers, but I hadn't even brewed the first pot. Before I could slide open the window, the SUV rolled forward, engine revving low and slow like it was growling. Then it just idled. Right there, 10 feet away, no headlights. I stood frozen. You work the graveyard long enough, you learn the difference between early caffeine zombies and something else. This was something else. Eventually, it rolled out of sight. I didn't think much of it. I told myself it was a Lyft driver taking a nap or some hungover kid from the college nearby, but I locked the back door anyway. 3:39 a.m., I changed into uniform. Did my usual routine. Mascara, lips, tied my hair into a high pony. The rain let up just a little. Enough to hear the gravel shift when someone stepped on it. That's when I noticed it. Footprints. In the mud right outside the back door. Barefoot. Human. I turned off the music. Nothing. Just the sound of my own breath. I went to the window again. Cracked it open. My finger hovered over the open switch. I told myself if I saw anyone weird again, I'd call the boss, or 911. But the lot was empty, so I flipped the sign on. The first car was Eric, my usual 4 a.m. regular. Mid-30s, divorced, always tipped a 20, and always tried too hard.
Hey, you alright?
He asked, eyeing me as I handed over his Americano. Just didn't sleep much. He grinned.
I could tire you out the right way.
I smirked and said nothing. Same old Eric. Then came 418. The SUV returned. This time it parked, window down. Driver didn't say anything for a few seconds. Just stared. It was hard to make out his face, but I could see the collarbones. No shirt, just a dark jacket draped open. Skin pale like he hadn't been outside in weeks.
You serving?
He finally asked. His voice sounded like gravel soaked in vodka.
Yeah, what can I get you?
He leaned forward.
What's not on the menu?
Here we go again, I thought. We've got a secret drink, I said, keeping it light. It's called Go Back to Bed, Double Shot, No Foam. He chuckled, then didn't speak again. Just watched me.
Look, if you're not ordering, I said, do you like being watched?
I paused. His eyes were darker than the glass around him.
but glassy, bloodshot, like he hadn't blinked in hours. "I'm closing the window now," I said, calm and flat. He didn't move, just whispered, "I liked it better before you put on the uniform." Then he drove away. I didn't report it or tell my boss. Honestly, I didn't want to give him another reason to lecture me about customer retention. But I did grab the box cutter and kept it on the shelf under the espresso machine. 4:43, a Toyota pulled in. A woman this time, probably late 40s, looked tired. Soccer mom type, ordered two lattes, normal, human. Then came the third return. Same SUV. This time, it didn't approach the window. It parked in the far corner of the lot, lights off, no engine. I pretended not to see it, just kept working, trying to shake off the tight coil forming under my ribs. At 5:05, I took out the trash. I know, dumb move, but it was routine, and I told myself routine was safe. The dumpster sat 20 yards behind the shack. One overhead light flickered nearby. As I tossed the bag in, I heard something moving behind it. I turned. Nothing. Just rain pooling into the cracks of the lot. On my way back, I saw it. A cell phone, propped up against the back wall, recording. It was angled up toward the changing station inside. My stomach bottomed out. I kicked the phone as hard as I could into the bushes and sprinted inside. I locked both doors, killed the lights, and slid down the wall and sat there, holding my knees, shaking. Not crying, just furious. Then I heard it again. The business phone was ringing. I got up and answered. "Java Junction," I said, voice cracking. Silence. Then,
"We need to go on a long drive, babe. Come to my house and let Daddy play." "I wrote this for you, babe. Do you like it? No games. That's how Daddy likes it. I'm coming for you."
I yanked the cord out of the wall. I didn't finish the shift. I left everything as it was, grabbed my things, and drove straight to the nearest gas station. I sat in the lot until the sun came up. I told my boss later that day I was quitting. I told him why. He asked if the customer had touched me. "No," I said.
"Then maybe you're overreacting."
He didn't even flinch. I never went back.
My first semester of college began with a roommate who spoke to ghosts. She introduced herself on move-in day as Lisa. She shoved her suitcase onto the shared bed frame and plopped a glass jar filled with dead flowers on her desk. That first night, I heard her whispering. At first, I thought she was on the phone. But when I turned my head, I saw her sitting cross-legged on the floor, hands in her lap, staring into the dark corner near the closet.
"They miss the way the air smelled before they drowned," she murmured. "They say the river was cold but calm. Peaceful."
I froze under my blanket. I was 18, newly out, still figuring myself out. I didn't need this. The next morning, I asked gently, "Were you talking to someone last night?" Lisa smiled.
"Yeah, they don't like silence."
She said they were her friends, dead ones. One had hung himself in a barn, another overdosed on painkillers, a third drowned during a lake party in junior year. She said they visited her often, protected her, talked to her. At first, I thought she was messing with me, but she told everyone, loudly, casually, like it was a hobby. Our RA, our floor mates, everyone heard her tell these stories like they were bedtime tales. She wasn't just strange, she was magnetic. People fell into her orbit and didn't notice when she pulled their teeth out with pliers. A few weeks in, Lisa announced she was engaged, showed us the ring, a thin silver band with a tiny opal, said her fiancé was moving to the city next year, said he wrote her letters, said he understood the dead spoke to her and still loved her. Then came Jack, a guy from our brother house. Dark hair, high cheekbones, always smelling like leather and weed. She brought him over twice before they started studying in her bunk behind the curtain. The walls were thin. By week 6, Jack was sleeping over every other night. I confronted her in the kitchen once while she let tomato sauce crust onto a pan that she had abandoned 3 days earlier. "You said you were engaged." "I am," she shrugged. "But Jack gets me in other ways." "You told your fiancé you were faithful." "Yeah, well, people lie." She said it like it was a recipe. Mix one part omission, two parts denial, a dash of sex, and stir until delusional. I wasn't the only one disgusted. Our other housemates, Kara and Melissa, started watching her, listening, documenting. It wasn't hard to find evidence. Elle had no filter. She talked about her affair like she was narrating a steamy soap opera. Sometimes she'd brag about making Jack cry, said he begged her to break it off with her fiancé. We weren't saints. We'd all done things we weren't proud of. But Lisa was different. She loved the chaos, breathed it in like oxygen. We emailed her fiancé. No threats, no screenshots, just a short note. "She's cheating. His name is Jack. You deserve better." The response came 3 days later. He showed up at our front door, middle of the afternoon. "Is Lisa home?" he asked, voice even. "Back room," Kara said. Her eyes didn't leave the book in her hand. He knocked. Lisa opened the door.
"Hey, babe,"
she chirped, pulling him in.
"I missed you."
He walked past her without a word and entered her room. Jack was there. 10 seconds later, a shout.
"You lying piece of shit!"
The door flew open. Her fiancé lunged at Jack, grabbed him by the collar.
"You touched her?"
"She said you were abusive, man."
"I what?"
I rushed to the hallway with Melissa. She had her phone out, recording, just in case. No one stepped in. Not yet. Lisa appeared in the doorframe, feigning shock.
"Stop! You're scaring me!"
That's when we stepped in. "Everyone calm down," I said. Her fiancé dropped his grip, breathing hard.
"She said I threatened to kill her if she left. That I stalked her. I moved cities to help her with school."
"She told us you hit her," I said. He stared at us wide-eyed. "She's never even seen me raise my voice." We watched him leave. Watched Lisa stand in the hallway 5 minutes later, crying for a crowd.
"He tried to hit me," she sobbed. "He came to hurt me."
"No, he didn't," Melissa snapped. "We were right there." Lisa's face shifted just slightly, like someone flipping a switch. Then she doubled down.
"I told you he was dangerous. Why else do you think I needed Jack?"
We didn't believe her. Not anymore. That night, we agreed she had to go. What we didn't know was how far she'd go to stay. 2 days later, Jack showed up with a black eye and a police report.
"She attacked me," he said, voice trembling. "She said I was ruining her life. Said if I didn't lie and say the fiancé hit her, she'd accuse me."
Melissa crossed her arms. "So now you're the victim." Jack shook his head.
"She's not well. She talks to the coroners, tells them secrets. She thinks she's a medium or something."
He moved out of his house a week later. Then the real mess began. Lisa started leaving knives on the kitchen counter, serrated ones, pointed toward the hallway. She put lipstick all over the bathroom mirror in what looked like writing, but backwards, illegible. We never caught her doing it. Then someone stole Melissa's necklace, a silver chain from her grandmother. We all denied it, but Lisa had taken to wearing turtlenecks, even in 80-degree weather. Melissa's mattress got sliced too. My shampoo was replaced with bleach. And on my desk one morning was a dead rose, freshly dead, with a single word written in ballpoint on a napkin.
Listen.
We couldn't prove it was her, but we knew. We took it to housing. 3 days later, they relocated her. Not expelled, just moved to another dorm on the opposite side of campus. We thought we were free. But that weekend, I woke up with the scent of smoke in my nose. Not fire, incense. My eyes burned. My window was open. On the floor was a matchbook, from a place in town none of us had been. I recognized the writing inside. Her slanted, angry cursive. Just two words. I remember. We never heard from her again after that semester. Rumor was she dropped out. Another rumor said she started a fire in her new dorm and blamed it on a student who was out of town. I don't know what was real anymore. Sometimes I wonder if she really could talk to the dead. This story is inspired from a real-life incident shared by one of our subscribers. This is what they said. In my first semester, I had a roommate, let's call her S, who believed she could see and talk to the ghosts of her dead friends. She shared vivid stories about them with all of us, and she wasn't joking. On top of that, she was engaged but started hooking up with a guy from a nearby house. We tipped off her fiancé, who caught them together. She denied everything, then claimed he was abusive. Though we all heard the argument, and he never even raised his voice. Living with her was chaos. She'd never cleaned, left stuff everywhere, and always blamed others for the mess. S was something else. I lived alone in an off-grid house in rural Oregon. I moved here with my husband George, but our marriage turned sour pretty fast. I won't go into details, but George was a terrible man. I had to put a restraining order against him. And the worst part was, all our friends sided with him after the divorce. He had a way of twisting things to make me seem like the bad person, even though he was the real problem. It was terrible. So, even though moving here was his idea, I stayed put while he went to shack up with his new girlfriend in the next town over. Good riddance. I felt lonely sometimes, but I had plenty of chickens to keep me company. 5 of them, in fact. And I felt closer to them than to any dog or cat that I'd ever had. My favorite chicken, Henrietta, followed me around everywhere. Such a beautiful girl. One evening, I was in the kitchen making dinner when I heard my chickens go absolutely wild outside. I rushed into the yard assuming that the possums were back. But there wasn't a possum outside. There was George. I saw his shadow as he crouched by the coop.
What the hell are you doing here?
George stood up and looked at me. That's when I saw Henrietta in his arms.
He was stealing my girl, my Henrietta! Stop! Give her back!
I raced after him, full of anger. Henrietta was a delicate creature. She couldn't handle the stress of being kidnapped. I almost caught up to him, but he jumped over my fence and disappeared into the forest. I went back inside and called the police to report the kidnapping. I tried to sound calm over the phone, but I was a total wreck. I could barely get the words out. And, to add insult to injury, the police dispatcher laughed. She actually laughed when I told her that Henrietta was a chicken. She said that officers would go to George's house in the morning. This obviously wasn't a priority to them. But I couldn't wait that long. I had to get Henrietta back. I called George's girlfriend. Thankfully, she didn't recognize my number. I pretended to be one of George's co-workers and asked where he was. She said that he went to get dinner. I was horrified. Did that mean he was going to eat Henrietta? I forced my voice to remain neutral.
Did he say what time he's getting back?
She had no idea. I couldn't get any other information out of her, so I ended the call. Now I was a woman on a mission. I got in my car and sped down the highway. The drive to George's house should have taken 40 minutes. I got there in 25. He was parking in his driveway when I pulled up. I was ready to confront him, but instead, I turned off my headlights and parked across the street. I watched him carry Henrietta inside, filled with rage that he wasn't even holding her properly. Once he was inside, I got out of my car and sneaked through his backyard. I could see him and his girlfriend talking in the living room. She didn't seem happy. I guess she had no idea that he went out to steal my chicken as some sort of revenge plot against me. They argued for a bit, while Henrietta walked around their living room. Poor girl looked so confused. I tried the back door, but it was locked. Then, I noticed that one of his windows was half open. I widened it as much as I could, and I quietly climbed into the kitchen. They were both still in the living room. I could hear their voices through the wall.
It's funny! Don't you think it's funny? It's sick! You need to stop obsessing over your ex! And what the hell are we gonna do with a damn chicken?
They kept bickering. It reminded me of how George and I used to talk to each other. He really was an annoying man. Rather than reveal myself, I crouched onto the floor and started to make quiet clicking noises. That's how I always called my chickens. I waited for Henrietta to come find me. My heart filled with joy as I saw my beautiful baby walk into the kitchen. Her feathers were a little ruffled, but she looked totally fine. And she wasn't alone. George's pug was with her. Henrietta was always good at making friends. I scooped Henrietta up in my arms, kissed her sweet head, and was ready to take her back home. Then, a dark thought crossed my mind. If George was going to steal from me, well, then I was going to steal from him. I tucked his pug under my other arm, quietly opened the kitchen door, and disappeared into the night. A half hour later, I was back home. Henrietta was safe in her coop, and George's pug was walking around my living room. It didn't take long for George to call. He knew what I'd done. He demanded his dog back. Of course, as soon as you tell me why you took Henrietta. I sat next to my laptop and turned on the audio recorder, just in case I needed to get his confession.
I took her because I was angry. I wanted to hurt you. But I promised to stay away forever. Are you happy?
That was all I needed to hear. I was about to tell him to come pick up his pug. But at that exact second, his stupid dog ran straight into the wall. He yelped in pain. I guess George thought that I was hurting his dog, and he absolutely flipped out. I could hear him crying on the phone.
I'm sorry, Sarah. Please. I was a terrible husband. You deserved better.
He kept going, apologizing for everything he'd ever done to me, including things I didn't even remember. He sounded so pitiful. And it was all because he was afraid of what I would do to his dog. I have no idea why some people are so attached to their dogs. It's weird. He went on and on, just totally breaking down. When he was finished, I had an extremely embarrassing recording. The next day, I dropped off his pug. We shook hands and we agreed to never see each other again. I went back home to spend some quality time with Henrietta and the girls. Oh, and of course, I sent his voice recording to all our friends. Served him right. This story is loosely inspired from a real-life incident. A 50-year-old man from Port Orchard, Washington, was arrested in late March after allegedly breaking into his ex-girlfriend's home and kidnapping her pet chicken, named Polly, in violation of an active protection order. According to the Kitsap County Sheriff's Office, deputies responded to a 911 call in the early hours of March 29th, reporting that the suspect had kicked down the victim's back door while shouting, "I've got Polly!" before fleeing the scene, clutching the fowl.
I landed in Florence with one suitcase, a mild sunburn from Barcelona, and three Tinder matches already swiping through my stories. The plan was simple. Cheap room, pasta in the plaza, art I pretended to care about, and maybe a story to tell someone hot over drinks back home in Chicago. The hotel I booked looked good in photos. Moody lighting, exposed brick, faux Renaissance headboards. In real life, it was a glorified hallway. I swear the entire building had the vibe of a Craigslist couch listing. Functional, kind of sketchy, and definitely full of stains. There was no front desk, just a WhatsApp number taped to a wall and some vague instructions. Every room had an electric key and zero human interaction. I called it ghost check-in. Obviously, I managed to lock my keycard in the room. My wallet, my phone charger, and my last protein bar were trapped inside. I WhatsApped the reception, which was probably just some guy vaping in a car. They replied 20 minutes later. Code to the office, 1397. Master key inside drawer. I found the office. I found the drawer. I found staples, an old map of Florence, and a dusty copy of Eat, Pray, Love. But no master key. I tore the place apart like a cracked out raccoon in a trash can. Nothing. Someone will come. Traffic bad, the WhatsApp dude said. No ETA, no apology. I had a walking food tour booked in an hour. I figured screw it. I'd go smell some cheese and drink some olive oil shots. Maybe the key situation would resolve itself. By the time I got to the tour, I was cranky, undercaffeinated, and looking like a girl who just emotionally yelled at a bookshelf. Our guide, Marco, was hot and a bit disheveled in that art school dropout kind of way. Hair messy on purpose, voice like melted cannolis. Hi, I blurted too loud. I locked myself out of my room. The hotel staff might be a catfish. He grinned. That's very Florent of them. Mid-tour, while we dipped chunks of bread into spicy olive tapenade, I confessed the full saga. He laughed like it wasn't his problem, which it wasn't, and offered to walk me back after the tour. Dave might have fixed it, he said, hands in his back pockets, like he didn't care if he had or hadn't. They hadn't. I stood outside my locked door, growing increasingly aware of how absolutely no one else seemed to be staying in this hotel. Marco leaned against the wall. You could crash at mine, he said. Now listen, I wasn't born yesterday. I was born 2 decades ago to Milwaukee and raised by a single mom who once punched a guy for touching her hair. But also, he was hot. It was dark, and I always wanted to say yes to a stranger in Europe. All right, I said. His apartment was 5 blocks away, up 3 flights of stairs that creaked like they were narrating my bad choices. It was cozy, books stacked sideways, vintage records, incense that smelled like regret. We hooked up, obviously. It was the kind of night you have when you're not sure if you'll see the person again and really don't care either way. I fell asleep on a futon with a hole in the cushion. The next morning, he was already dressed, a scarf slung around his neck like a budget art critic. He muttered something about tours and time and stress. I have 3 groups today, he said, kissing my forehead. I took that as text me later, which I did, twice, and no reply. Now here's where I probably should have let it go. Should have gotten a cannoli, visit Duomo, and then cry in a bathroom stall like a reasonable adult. Instead, I went to his apartment. I figured it would be romantic. A chaotic American girl surprising her Tuscan fling. Maybe we'd hook up again. Maybe he'd give me a free gelato. What I found instead was a blonde woman in a silk shirt passed out on his couch. Marco? I called out. He walked out of the bathroom in just a towel. When he saw me, his face froze like someone had pressed pause. His mouth opened, but no sound came out. Guess you found your master key, I said, flipping him off. I left without waiting for an answer. I bought pizza and cried for 20 seconds, and then I decided that I would stalk his next tour. It wasn't hard. His voice carried across the piazza like a TED talk. He was talking to a group of tourists about Michelangelo's David, probably inventing half the facts. I walked right up, right in front of the group of Midwestern women who were already in love with him. He saw me, and I saw him see me. Then I punched him. Just once, just hard enough that he stumbled back. My ex is a boxer, I announced, even though he wasn't. And I lied about locking myself out. I just wanted to see if the sex would be worth it. It wasn't. Gasps, laughter, and one guy clapped. I walked away like I was on fire. 2 days later, I checked into a real hotel with real staff, and I didn't touch the minibar at a principal. I slept like a Roman goddess. That would have been the end of it, except a week later, someone DM'd me on Instagram. It had a screenshot of a TripAdvisor review. Marco was charming, but don't fall for it. My friend got scanned the exact same way. She stayed in one of the hallway hostels he manages, He picks a girl, plays hero, then rescues her to his apartment. I stared at the screen. He worked at the hotel. He locked me out on purpose. The whole office key bullshit was theater. The WhatsApp replies? Probably him in the next room. And I fell for it. I wish I could say I was shocked or heartbroken or even embarrassed. But honestly, I'm impressed. It was a thought-out con with great lightning. My friend back in Chicago said I should report him, but I didn't. I wrote this story instead. Because sometimes heartbreak isn't the villain. Sometimes it's just the foreplay. And Florence? Florence wasn't real. It was just the set. The story was inspired from a real-life travel story shared by one of my really pretty Broccoli Fam subscribers. She told me the following. The place I was staying at in Florence was more of a corridor lined with rooms than a proper hotel. Each room had a key card entry, but there was no staff on site, just a number to call for help. Naturally, I managed to lock myself out. I messaged the contact and sent me a code to access the admin room where a universal key was supposedly kept. I searched that office like a detective in a crime show, every drawer and shelf, and nothing. They said someone would come by, but traffic was bad and it would take time. I had a tour book, so I figured I would go and do that while it updated, but the message never came. I told my tour guide what was going on, and since I was the last person on the tour, he offered to walk me back. Seeing my situation, he invited me to crash at his place for the night, and while one thing led to another, it was impulsive, I guess. But we're still in touch and chat often, so no regrets. The cleaning lady finally got me back in my room at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Last year, I started college in a small town in Massachusetts where my mom had grown up. My Aunt Lucy still lives in the town, and I asked her if I could stay at her house for the first semester. Unsurprisingly, she said no. She'd always been a really cold person. My mom always said that Lucy was jealous of her, but I didn't really believe that. I always thought that she was just mean. When the semester started, I ended up taking out an extra loan and paying for the cheapest dorm on campus. It was awful. My roommate Taryn was a real party girl. She would wake me up at all hours of the night and I could barely sleep. After 3 weeks of putting up with Taryn, I had finally had enough. I needed somewhere where I could sleep throughout the night. So I showed up at Aunt Lucy's house and asked if I could stay there until the morning. She could tell that I was desperate, so she reluctantly agreed. It was nice to be in the old family home. This was where my mom grew up, and I'd never been there before. My mom had died in a car accident about a year before, so I felt like I was somehow reconnecting with her. Aunt Lucy gave me a tour of the place and set me up in the upstairs guest room. She told me that I could go anywhere in the house, but I had to stay out of the attic. She said it was dangerous up there. I agreed. It didn't seem like a big deal. But in the middle of the night, I woke up to sounds coming through the ceiling. Footsteps. Someone was walking around in the attic. Before my mom had died, she used to sleepwalk. I thought that maybe Aunt Lucy was doing the same thing, which would have been pretty bad if the attic was as dangerous as she had said. So I got out of bed and walked to the pull-down door on the hallway ceiling. I yanked on the rope and a little trap door opened up. A wooden ladder unfolded to the floor. I climbed up the ladder and stuck my head into the attic. It was very dark up there. I looked around, but I couldn't see anything. I couldn't hear anything either. Then, I heard chains rattling and footsteps rushing toward me. A woman ran out of the darkness, her hair covering her face. I was so startled, I fell backwards off the ladder and onto the floor. The fall knocked the wind out of me. When I looked up, a woman was peering down at me. I could see that her wrists were chained up so she couldn't climb down the ladder. "Who are you?" I asked. The woman pulled the hair out of her face, and I gasped. It was my own mother. How could she be here now? She was dead. Someone grabbed my shoulder and pulled me to my feet. It was Aunt Lucy. "I told you not to look in the attic," she screamed. "My mother's alive?" I asked. "She's chained up in here?" Aunt Lucy shook her head sadly. "That's not your mother," she mumbled. "It sure looked like her." The woman babbled unintelligibly, closing and opening her mouth like a fish. She was trying to talk to me, but I could see that her tongue was gone. I could tell by her desperate expression that she wasn't a threat. She was begging for my help. I pushed Aunt Lucy and started back up the ladder. I raised my arm toward the woman, ready to untie her wrists and find out what had happened to her. I was halfway up the ladder when Lucy grabbed me by the waist and pulled me back down. "That's not your mother," she said again. "Then who is it?" "It's your mother's identical twin, our other sister. Our family has kept her hidden all her life, ever since she killed our father. My mom always told me Grandpa died of cancer, but I guess not." "That's her twin?" I asked. "Yes," said my aunt. "And did Mom know about this?" "Of course she did," Lucy said. "Your mother has always been racked with guilt over what happened. That's why she drove off the road. She couldn't handle the guilt." "I couldn't imagine doing this to my own family member. It was unhuman. I demanded that Aunt Lucy let this woman go." "I can't," Lucy said. "She's a murderer. She'll be taken to jail." "It's better than being locked up in an attic," I said. "She's filthy and starving." Aunt Lucy tried to hold me back, but I grabbed her by the shoulders. I held her down and demanded that she give me the keys to that woman's shackles. Without any other choice, Aunt Lucy pulled off her necklace, revealing that she was wearing the keys on her neck. I ripped off the keys and then scrambled up the ladder. Mom's twin babbled something, but I couldn't understand her. I grabbed her wrist and started to unlock the chains. From the hallway below me, Lucy screamed for me to stop. I refused. I untied my poor aunt, and she wrapped me in a big hug. Even though she was much sicker and thinner than my own mother, it still felt like I was hugging my mom. It felt nice. "She's going to kill you too," Lucy screamed. The woman tried to tell me something else, but I still couldn't understand the noises that were coming out of her mouth. So she gave up and shoved her palm into my face. It took me a while to realize what this woman was doing. She was showing me a scar just below her thumb, the same scar that my mother had. That's when I realized that Aunt Lucy had been lying to me. This wasn't my mother's twin. This was my mother. Aunt Lucy had faked my mom's death and kept her here all this time. She chained her to the wall and cut out her tongue. But why? I looked down to see Aunt Lucy slowly raise the ladder. "You should have listened to me," she said. Then she closed the door, trapping both me and my mother in the dark attic. I was now alone with my mom. There was no escape and no way to call for help. The attic had a tiny window overlooking the yard, but the house was too secluded for anyone to be close enough to see us. In the dim light, Mom used charades to explain what happened. It was just as I thought. Lucy caused the car accident. She took my mom back here and has kept her trapped here for over a year. My aunt was an absolute psycho. I felt so sad and hopeless. Would my aunt cut out my tongue too? Would she kill us both? Then a miracle happened. I heard a car pull up into the driveway. I looked through the tiny window and saw Taryn walk toward the house. She came to find me. I couldn't believe it. I pounded on the window so she could see me. At first, she didn't. Then just before she reached the front door, she looked up and saw me. I used my fingers to spell out 911. She nodded in understanding and then got back into her car to call the police. I'm so glad she didn't try to go inside, because who knows what my aunt would have done to her. Almost instantly, the cops arrived. I saw them through the window. Two officers walked up to Taryn and asked her something. I couldn't hear what she said, but I saw her point toward the window, right at me. I waved at them for help, and then they ran inside the house. They arrested Aunt Lucy, of course. She's in a mental hospital now, and my mother is in a real hospital, recovering from the malnutrition and wounds that she'd suffered this last year. I still can't understand why my own aunt would be so cruel to her sister. I just hope that my mom can live as full of life as possible. I'm even learning sign language to help her adjust when she gets out of the hospital. Taryn and I are now best friends. We both live in my family house and carpool to campus. I don't know where I'd be without her. All I know is that as long as we're in this house, no one is going in the attic again.